By the time that Paul writes the letter here to the Ephesians, it's fairly apparent that the church there is an established congregation. We have an interesting situation with the church in Ephesus, and that interesting situation is that we have probably more written to or about that particular congregation than most any other congregation in the New Testament. I'm not sure if you realize that or not, but we have, first of all, the letter that we have here, Ephesians. In Acts chapter 19, we see the beginnings of the church in Ephesus, and we see that Ephesus was sort of a hub. It was the place where most of Asia heard the word of the Lord, as Paul is as said there. In Acts chapter 20, Paul is on his way to Jerusalem, and he calls the Ephesian elders to talk to them, and he tells them the kind of things that they need to remember. We also have the book of 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 3, Paul says, "As I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain at Ephesus, that you may charge certain persons, etc., etc., etc." Timothy's gone to Ephesus. He's there, and he says, "I want you to stay there." And then he gives him this whole letter to 1 Timothy. So whatever he's telling Timothy in 1 Timothy, applies to the church in Ephesus. And then, of course, in Revelation chapter 2, 1 through 7, we have that particular church again mentioned in the book of Revelation. It's the very first one mentioned. All of this reveals a lot about the congregation. It tells us just a whole lot about what's going on. Gives us some really, I think, fairly important and dramatic insights. The one that I want us to think about today is we see a church beyond its adolescent days. And I think that's a very significant feature. It is a church that requires a certain amount of organization. Okay? A lot of times we eschew some sort of organization. It gets clumsy the bigger you get, you know, and businesses get bigger and bigger, and they get clumsier and clumsier the bigger you get. You try to pare it down to essential things. But you need some kind of structure when a group gets to a certain size. And I think we cannot ignore this for several reasons. Number one, some sort of division of labor is just very much a natural part of life. Some players play second base. Some players play center field. Some players are catchers. Some are pitchers. There's a coach. Okay? We divide things up because it's kind of necessary to get all the jobs done. Secondly, the functions mentioned in this particular section have very clearly been granted to the church by God and by the grace of God, and by the fact that when Jesus ascended, he sent back gifts to us. So somehow God's at work in all of those things, and we need to be able to recognize that. And I think also, understanding what he's doing here, we can see also that growth demands a certain amount of structure. When the work grew burdensome for Moses, we are told that he appointed leaders to lead the community in Exodus chapter 18. And in Numbers chapter 11, verses 16 and following, it's very clearly done that he appoints 70 other elders to help him with the work. One of the events is prompted by his father-in-law, Jethro. He says, "You're wearing yourself out. You need to get some guys to help you here." And the other is simply clearly prompted by the Spirit of God. We assume the first one does as well, but it's Jethro that makes the suggestion to him. But Moses is doing what makes sense. Get others to help with the work and get them involved in what's going on. The issue for the leaders here at Ephesus, I think, is twofold, as we read it in this section. Number one is to build up the body of Christ. Okay? It's to make them strong. And number two, it's to actually equip them for works of service. You know, a lot of times we think of the leaders as just sort of making decisions. The leaders are equippers. They are people who are involved with the lives of the people in the congregation in such a way that it actually helps them to do the work. It spreads out the responsibility a little bit, so it's not all on one or two persons' shoulders. Those are the kind of things we need to look at today as we think about what Paul says here. Now, I want you to imagine, I didn't hand it out to you again, I want you to imagine the mission triangle we handed out last week. Oh, Floyd has his with him, okay? Well, you know, that's great because, you know, preachers hand things out. And we like to believe that when we hand things out, that you're going to stuff it away somewhere, maybe carry it with you like Floyd's doing, and it's going to be the definitive thing that really changes your life. You know, we have these grandiose ideas about what we hand out. You know, it's going to really make a difference with everybody. Well, I'm glad it does with at least one person here, okay? Anyway, I'm being a little facetious, but, you know, the fact is, I think that mission triangle, if you can at least envision it, it's a little way of visually understanding what the church is trying to do. In the bottom right-hand corner, if you do go back and find the one, which is probably in your trash at this point, you'll see that one of the things I put there on the corner was works of service, Ephesians chapter 4, 11 through 13. One of our missions is to do that, along with outreach, Matthew 28, and spiritual practices, Acts chapter 2, verse 42. All those things comprise what our mission is. And so today we're kind of looking at that one little part of the triangle as a part of what our mission is. Now, let's go through the passage, and I'll try to get through it quickly. When preachers, again, when we try to exegete things, this could take a long time because there are a lot of details here, but I'm giving you sort of the structure, you know, the framing, so to speak, of what's going on here. Notice how Paul begins this section, however. He begins it with our calling. And he assumes by that every one of us have been called to the church, to be a part of the community of God's people. And he says, I want you to walk worthily of the calling. Now, you'll notice one other thing that Paul is doing here. This is all a sort of grand conclusion to what he has just done in verses 1 through 3. He says, therefore, as a result of everything I've said in chapters 1 through 3, here's how you are supposed to live. And when he says you are to walk worthily of the calling, he gives some specific details to it. He doesn't just kind of leave you hanging and say, okay, just be good. He gets very detailed here. And he says, basically, he gives us the virtues that we need to interact as a community of people. And you'll notice he says, walk in a manner worthy of the calling. And verse 2, with all humility, and so on and so forth. That's sort of a rhetorical device for Paul. And that rhetorical device just simply underscores the importance of these particular virtues that he's going to mention. So he says, let's really get to it with these, is essentially what he's trying to say here. But he mentions humility, lowliness of mind, in contrast perhaps with a high-minded haughtiness. Galatians 6:3, Romans 12:3, Philippians 2:3, they all teach the same thing. React to one another with humility. Look at yourself and don't think too highly of yourself. You're not any more important than anybody else. You may have only been given one gift. God doesn't care. You are still important. And don't anybody think, because you may have two or three, that you're more important than anybody. That's the point that Paul is making. React to each other with humility. That's how you engage other people. These passages, along with 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 5, where he tells the young men and old men to kind of react to one another with humility, suggest that it is an absolutely indispensable quality for the community. Engage each other in a spirit of humility. Not a spirit of judgment, but a spirit of humility. And then he mentions a second one. He mentions this idea of gentleness. Defined by one particular commentator I looked at as courtesy, considerateness, and willingness to waive one's rights that come from seeking a common good without being concerned for personal reputation or gain. That's kind of a lengthy definition there, but it's the idea of gentleness, courtesy, and considerateness, consideration for each other. And I have to tell you, again, as a preacher, as someone standing up, it's so tempting. You know, when you're trying to get an idea across, if people don't get it, well, say it louder. You know, like somehow you say it louder, everybody's going to get it better. You know, it doesn't work. I can tell you for a fact that those, you know, you do the same thing when you're talking to somebody in a foreign language or they don't know English well, so you say it slower as if somehow that's going to make them understand it better. It doesn't work. But, you know, enforcing yourself and just getting really, you know, angry, whatever, that's not what Paul is talking about here. You know, show some consideration for the other people in the congregation. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 23 suggests that it is a fruit of the Spirit that gives us that. It is the appropriate quality needed, according to 2 Timothy chapter 2, to correct opponents. Paul tells Timothy, correct them with gentleness. Basically, it's God that's going to change their minds. God's Spirit has got to react in their hearts. Correct them with gentleness. Get the idea out there, but do it gently. He mentions also patience and bearing with one another. I think the second there is kind of an amplification of the first. Be patient. Bear with each other. You know, people are going to have their foibles and their little strange things they do and say. You have to be able to realize there's still some good in there somewhere. Walking worthily demands all of these things from us. Maintaining unity also demands them. And that's the point Paul is trying to get to here about what they're supposed to do. And it's kind of pointless once we get to this section here in verses 4 through 6 to kind of talk about the whole oneness thing unless we seek to implement these qualities that promote oneness. Now, oneness is important to Paul, no question about it. God's oneness and the list of all the other things that he does demonstrate the need for and give kind of a theological foundation for unity. But if we're not doing the things he says in the beginning, all the theological foundation is sort of beside the point. It doesn't really get us to behave in a unified way. It is, I think, as Paul says here, the bond of peace that holds unity together and provides the necessary framework for growth and to thrive as a community. Strife destroys unity. That's why when he says, here's how you can walk worthily of the calling. Humility, patience, gentleness, etc., etc. Those are the things you do. But there is another thing. Paul continues on really from this point, and I think this is what we need to think about as we think about how the church grows. And, you know, when it gets to a certain point, God is at work in the community. Chapter 4, verse 7. The grace, but grace, was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. You know, I'm not sure we recognize a certain sacredness about what God has given to each one of us. We should. Whatever God has given us, it's given us because God has given it to us. You know, there's a certain grace involved in all of that. God is involved in it in some way or others. And this whole discussion, again, the sort of theological discussion about Christ ascending and descending, et cetera, that's all to make this point that Christ has sent back things to us to help the church and to be with the church. Christ gave the gifts lifted here. They aren't arbitrary nor unnecessary. They are essential for the growth and development of the church. And I'd like to kind of talk about that in terms of how we think about ourselves. You know, we talk about the priesthood of believers, and I think sometimes we mistakenly sort of extend that to mean, well, all these other offices, if you want to call them offices for just a moment, you know, they don't really demand, the whole idea of the priesthood of believers doesn't demand some sort of official capacities. Well, let's not forget here, where is 1 Timothy written to? It's written to Timothy. Where is Timothy? Timothy's here in Ephesus. And what are one of the things that we see in the book of 1 Timothy that Paul is telling him? He says, I want you to appoint elders and I want you to appoint deacons. And here are the qualities for those. So it must be pretty important to Paul, must be pretty important for the growth of the church here to have some leadership and for them to develop leadership perhaps. Is a very, very critical idea. These offices have more value than we think. I read a very interesting article this week. Those of us who live in the New York area know about Lin Sanity. Jeremy Lin, basketball player for the New York Knicks. Taiwanese origin. That's where his parents were from, so he's Chinese. He was traded actually to New York last year from the Houston Rockets. Well, they traded him back this year. And this year, Jeremy Lin got a contract, I think 3 years for $25 million, okay, which was quite a bit different than when they released him last year. Okay, he had a great year with the Knicks, and they seemed to think he was worth that. Some have questioned whether he was really worth it. You know, they wondered whether a couple of weeks of of a flashiness was really worth what they gave him. But I read an article this week that suggested, you know, there's more to that than meets the eye. And I don't know if this is true, but this particular commentator was suggesting that Jeremy Lin is worth to them not just what he can do on the court, but how many goods and things he can sell by his name. You know where the NBA is extremely popular? It's in China. I mean, it is extremely popular in China. And even before Jeremy Lin got there, they put up something on their website, pre-order your Jeremy Lin jersey. You know, and this particular writer was saying, you know what? The Houston Rockets are probably going to make several times over what they pay him, you know, in terms of his salary. They're going to make it just by all the things that Jeremy Lin can sell for them. So, and I don't know, again, what the thought of was by the people who own the Houston Rockets, whether they had that in mind or not. I wouldn't be surprised. Let's face it, it's all about the money. But they saw some value in Jeremy Lin that even extended beyond what we might think might be his pure value as a player, as a contributor to the team, and perhaps taking them to the finals. I think we might do the same thing sometimes with these quote-unquote offices of the church. I think maybe they're worth a little more than we sometimes give them credit for. Once a church moves beyond a certain stage, it kind of needs that structure. It needs people who can equip others to do the work. And the graces that he mentions here, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers, and so forth, you know, those things are all, they all play a role in helping the church to grow. And for us thinking, we can do this on our own, or we can do it without that kind of structure, I don't think so. Why would God give us all those things otherwise? Okay. And I want you to notice the purposes of those things, what these particular things are trying to do for us. And first of all, notice that they are called graces in verse 7. These gifts, it is grace that is giving us these things, and gifts they are called. Number one, they are to equip the saints for works of service. These things are meant to help all of us do what God wants. Define works of service any way you want at this point. Okay, I'm not all that worried about it. The fact is, the leadership is meant to equip the saints for works of service. They are to build up the body of Christ, verse 12. They are to make us stronger. They are teachers. They are guides. Spiritual mentors. Verse 13, the point of these graces is for unity and maturity. Now, Paul has already stressed the whole unity thing and how important that the things that we do play a role in developing unity and maintaining the unity that is the very nature of God himself and the very nature of the church. And he says, basically, I want you to grow up. You got to mature. You know, we can all grow old. We do that whether we try or not. The question is whether or not we're going to grow up in the process. Paul is telling us here that God's given us those gifts so that we will mature, that the church would grow up. It is to avoid false teachings. And we bring back some question here about what's right and what's wrong, about the importance of knowing what the church is teaching, the importance of knowing what God has done. Those things become very important when you look at how Paul structures the particular things he wants them to do here. They are to help people avoid false teachings, verses 14 and 15. And they are to help the church grow properly in love, verses 15 and 16. The formality, if we want to talk about it in terms of a formality or the structure of these offices, must be understood in the light of the leadership as defined in many other places in the New Testament. The leaders are not to lord it over anybody else. They're to be like shepherds involved with the sheep. They love the sheep. They're willing to sacrifice for them. And I think they're supposed to recognize that they are not detached from them, but there's a close relationship. Paul talks about the relationships in the church as if they were brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. Go back and read Titus and you'll see all of those terms used in our relationships with one another. So the leadership that is given is not meant to be simply these people way up here and the rest of us down here, but they are in there nonetheless, working to build us up. And the question I guess I'm really trying to get to for ourselves here was, what are we to make of all this for our church? Here at the Chatham Church of Christ, Chatham, New Jersey, 2012, August, okay? What are we to make of all this? How is this supposed to function for us? What are we to do with this? What are we doing to produce a new generation of workers and leaders? Really? I mean, what are we doing? I'm kind of asking that because I want to start a discussion with this, okay? How can we develop leaders? You know, some of us here have got gray hair. And, you know, at some point, the torch has to be passed to a new generation. And we want you to realize that we want to pass that torch to you. We want to help you be able to take the torch. Now, we're not just going to hand it off and leave you, you know, hanging, expect you to run with it. But we'd like to have a discussion about how can we develop you as leaders? How can those of us who are elders here to kind of make that happen? I mean, I think there are several elements here. We have to be able to spend time together. We have to practice hospitality. Being in each other's homes is very much a part of being out there shepherding and so forth. I think we need to read things and talk to each other and encourage each other in some way. It takes time. We need to encourage spiritual growth in some way or other. And I guess I'm just opening up a conversation for us to say, how can we do that? And let me put it in terms of what I've been trying to say over the last couple weeks, which is, again, coming up in our 40 days of prayer starting in October. How can we talk about out of the salt shaker leadership? How can we develop that? Because God says, or Jesus says, we're the salt of the earth. Okay, you don't leave salt in the salt shaker. You get it out where it's useful. How can we talk about, with you and with all of us, out of the salt shaker leadership? How can we develop that? What can we do? All right. I'm not suggesting I have a definitive answer, but I'm kind of opening up a discussion because it's got to happen. The torch has got to be passed at some point, and we want to see how that can best work. Let's not forget, in Matthew chapter 9, verses 36 through 38, Jesus told us, pray for more workers. Now, I know he had the idea of evangelists there, but I kind of think he maybe had even more in mind than that. Because clearly, he is the source of all the workers in Ephesians 4 and 11. He gave some to be, in verse 11 of this passage. So pray. Pray about your own life. How can you be a leader? Prayer perhaps should be followed by, here am I, send me. With the thought that, you know, I might need a little help. I need some guidance. You know, God didn't leave Moses all by himself, even though Moses really didn't want to go. Joshua, he didn't leave by himself either. He was there with him. And so we need to keep that in mind. So I conclude with simply three things that I'm driving at today. Number one, let us figure out how we can equip new leaders. All right, what do we need to do with that? How can we satisfy that little third corner of our triangle? Let's pray about getting out of the salt shaker. How can we do that? How will it work for us to do that? There's no right or wrong answer, but there's a way we have to kind of try to do that. And number three, and probably the most important one, is the one we started with. Let us continue to humble ourselves before one another and maintain the unity in the bond of peace. Let's stand.